ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Environment Minister gives the green light for Australia's biggest gas project to keep operating until 2070. Also in the United States, investigators release video footage of the man suspected of killing Conservative campaigner Charlie Kirk. And for the first time, two Queensland clubs clashing in the AFL finals.
So excited. I've been waiting a long time for this weekend. It's taken a while to get here. Yeah, been members for, 13 years? So yes, yeah. Long time coming.
The Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt has given the go-ahead for Australia's biggest gas project to keep operating until at least 2070. Woodside's Northwest Shelf processing plant is near Karratha, about 1,500 kilometres north of Perth in WA. It sits alongside Indigenous rock art thought to be 60,000 years old, and its opponents argue that heritage-listed site is threatened by air pollution from the plant. The ABC's Charlie Mills is in Karratha.
So this is an onshore gas processing facility. It is actually quite near two towns here in the Pilbara. Dampier, which is the coastal town, and a little further inland, about 30 minutes drive, is the main town of Karratha. If you drive out there onto the Burrup Peninsula, it is actually pretty hard to miss. It's quite a large gas processing facility. It actually involves two different facilities in this Northwest Shelf area. That includes the Karratha gas plant, which was the original built a few decades ago, and then the more recent Pluto LNG plant. It's visible from essentially all areas of Karratha and Dampier, especially in the early morning and evening, because the gas flare actually towers above those hills and can often be seen from quite the distance away. It's designed to process gas that is mined offshore from a series of different basins, including Carnarvon. There's also a planned Browse Basin that is subject to another environmental approval. And then that gas is processed here onshore in the Pilbara and then shipped for export and domestic use.
So the Environment Minister Murray Watt has given the approval for the extension of its operation today. What are the conditions he's announced as well?
Yeah, so he's announced 48 additional restrictions, which he says are in order to avoid and mitigate significant impacts to Aboriginal rock art that is present on the Burrup Peninsula. That is in addition to a series of restrictions already placed by the WA government. Now, the actual letter of those conditions will become more clear as the Environment Department publishes them online and distributes them, but we do know that it will require a reduction in emissions. Here is Minister Watt speaking earlier.
The conditions will ensure that this project will be operated in a way that does not cause unacceptable impacts to the Murujuga rock art, including by restricting air emissions. Specifically, I've imposed conditions that will require a reduction in certain gas emissions below their current levels, in some cases by 60% below their current levels by 2030, with ongoing reductions beyond that.
The Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt. Charlie, what does that all mean for both industry and the traditional owners of the land?
Well, essentially, what we see this as is it'll legislate some things that are already happening, requiring by law companies to hold themselves to account on already existing cultural heritage management plans. Now, as part of the announcement today, the minister also announced a partial declaration to protect a significant Aboriginal cultural heritage site. That comes under the Federal Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Heritage Protection Act, and it applies when a heritage site faces injury or desecration. That means additional legal restrictions are placed over part of the area to ensure Murujuga's ancient rock art is appropriately protected into the future. That will become clearer as these restrictions also become clearer. But mainly Woodside, as well as some other companies that engage in industry on the peninsula, will need to engage with traditional owners as well as the scientific research on the impact of emissions of rock art.
And has there been any reaction from the traditional owners as yet to this announcement?
We're still hearing some of that reaction, but there's no doubt that even with those conditions, there is going to be a great deal of concern from traditional owners, as well as environmental groups and foreign countries. We know that a challenge was launched to this project by Pilbara traditional owner Raylene Cooper. There is going to be concern over the fact that during the time in which the Murujuga cultural landscape was given a World Heritage status by the UNESCO World Heritage Committee, the minister then said that there was no acceptable impact to rock art. That's now a discussion, essentially, between the federal government, Woodside, and about the emissions and how they impact rock art in this area, whether or not the restrictions that is placed by the federal government are actually going to do enough to protect that rock art. The move, of course, has already been welcomed by Woodside, who are confident in their ability to meet those restrictions placed by the government. We've also heard today from the local Chamber of Commerce head here in Karratha. She's told us it's welcome news for local businesses and the local economy, but did say that there would have been an impact over this long wait period in between the initial approval and the final approval.
The ABC's Charlie Mills speaking to me from Karratha in WA. In the United States, authorities are still searching for the gunman who killed the conservative commentator and political activist Charlie Kirk. It's been more than a day since the Trump ally was shot dead at a Utah university, the latest act of political violence to shock the nation. Investigators have now released surveillance camera footage and images of the suspected assassin, and they believe they've found the weapon. Isabel Masali prepared this report.
If you look up to the top left, you'll see the building where the shooter was proned out.
A highly publicised show and tell on one of the most wanted suspects in the United States. Utah Public Safety Commissioner Beau Mason explains what's happening on the grainy footage taken on the university where conservative activist Charlie Kirk was shot dead. It shows a person in dark clothing moving across a roof.
So here you see the suspect ran behind that upper building. He's going to come out on the right, moves to this far right corner. As he does, he's going to climb off the edge and then drop down to the ground. As he did that, he left some palm impressions. There's some smudges, some places we're looking to collect DNA. There's a shoe imprint where we believe the suspect is clearly identified as wearing Converse tennis shoes.
The FBI have released this video along with some still photos to get the public's help in tracking down what's described as an evil human being.
You're going to see a very distinctive t-shirt with an American flag and appears to have an eagle on it. There's also a baseball cap with a triangle on it and a pair of sunglasses. All distinctive, all things that we would ask the public to look for and try to identify if they know someone who has those items, who has been seen wearing those items. We're looking for all that information.
As the footage continues after the shooting, the man crosses the street and moves into a wooded area where authorities found a high-powered bolt-action rifle that's believed to be the weapon used. No name or motive have been provided, and questions were not taken during the press conference. But the public appeal confirms authorities are still struggling to find the person responsible for the fatal shooting of Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University, where he spoke publicly. Charlie Kirk was a polarising figure who founded the organisation Turning Point, dedicated to advancing conservative causes. Utah Governor Spencer Cox says authorities will pursue the death penalty for his killer.
This is not just a local matter here in Utah. We have people all over the country that are helping to bring this perpetrator to justice for Charlie Kirk and his family.
Kenneth Gray is a former FBI agent based in Connecticut. He says while it's early on, investigators have made rapid progress.
From only having a shadowy figure on top of a building, now actually having a photograph of the person. And it is my understanding that law enforcement has developed the name of this person of interest and is looking to confirm that. But naming him is only half of the equation. The other half is actually locating him, finding him. And so that's the next step, is to actually go about finding this person, digging into this person and finding out what they're all about, and actually locating them and arresting them.
On campus today, it was eerily quiet. Classes have been cancelled until next week, and many students and nearby residents are staying inside. Henry Dells has been reflecting on the tragic event. He had asked Charlie Kirk a question just moments earlier, and he says there was a disturbing lack of security.
I thought it was very, very weird when I showed up to the campus. There was no security at all. I was looking around and I was like, I love Charlie, but I have a weird feeling that if something did happen, he would be in a very vulnerable position.
Vigils have been held in Utah and across the U.S. And at Florida Atlantic University, some students have vowed to continue Charlie Kirk's work as a conservative communicator.
He helped millions of people in this world, and his message is still going to go on. We're still going to say his name every day. We're still going to be a part of Turning Point. Turning Point next year and even this year is going to be bigger than ever. We're going to keep his message alive. We're going to keep Trump's message alive, Charlie Kirk's message alive. We're going to keep all of their messages alive, and we love them so much.
A $100,000 reward is on offer for information leading to the killer's arrest.
Isabel Massali. In the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination, the Prime Minister is urging Australians to value the democratic process and reject violence. While there are clear differences in the political cultures of the US and Australia, the nation's intelligence chief has been warning of the risk of politically motivated violence in this country, and researchers say social media is fostering extreme views. Kimberly Price has more.
Political violence is not a new phenomenon, but experts say it is evolving. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese called for peaceful debate in Australia in the wake of Charlie Kirk's death.
Political violence has no role. On the 3rd of May, we had a democratic election. People went along and voted and had their political say through the ballot box. That's the way the issues should be dealt with.
The situation in Australia is nowhere near as volatile as in the US, but it's far from perfect. This country's own terrorism threat level was raised from possible to probable in August 2024. At the time, Intelligence Chief Mike Burgess cited the increase in politically motivated violence as a concern. Samantha Jones is a criminologist at Charles Sturt University. She believes political violence is a growing problem around the world.
We tend to go through spikes in extremism in Australia. You have to remember that it isn't what it was like, a couple of decades ago. The media and social media play a big part in the propaganda and the movement of information, more so now than it ever did before.
Do you think we're in the grips of this spike, not just Australia but everywhere?
Absolutely. That spike has been taking place for quite a number of years.
Australia has its own experiences of extremism, including the racially motivated Cronulla riots in 2005. More recently, the rise of anti-Semitic attacks have prompted the Jewish community to worry about its safety. And 2 weeks ago, the March for Australia rallies were held to protest against what organisers called mass migration. Neo-Nazis took part, and some went on to storm a sacred Indigenous site in Melbourne. Professor Mark Davies from the University of Melbourne specialises in online extremism.
The ideal of politics is it's based around civility and the better argument winning, and I think we've transitioned into a society where it's not so much about civility anymore, it's about harvesting anger. And we've seen our fair share of that in Australia, absolutely.
Professor Davies believes the nature of public conversations have changed, which can lead to more extreme behaviour.
So the kinds of conversations that we're having now that make up our public sphere are no longer so mutual. They're no longer so facing the other person and saying, okay, I disagree with you, but I see where you're coming from. They're more dismissive and they're more aggressive.
As for whether the fallout from the murder of Charlie Kirk in America will stoke tensions in Australia, Professor Davies says politically extreme conversations on social media are not constrained by national borders.
More and more people feel licensed to take out their anger on other people. And I think social media has got a lot to do with that. because social media, you don't have to take consequences for your actions. So you can say extreme things on social media. You can say, you know, I don't just disagree with you, but I hate you and I think you should no longer exist, you know, and you can get away with that on social media because there's no consequences for the way you talk.
Several rival protest groups are again planning to take to the streets across the country this weekend, some to protest against migration and others in response to the Israel-Gaza conflict.
Kimberly Price. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a big moment in the evolution of the AFL as the two Queensland clubs clash in the finals. Australia's special envoy to counter Islamophobia is urging the federal government to outlaw religious discrimination and review counter-terrorism laws. Aftab Malik handed the Prime Minister his report featuring 54 recommendations today. He's also calling for inquiries into the prevalence of Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism. Mr Albanese says his government will now give the recommendations careful consideration. Diana Damjanovic reports.
Fatin Eldana knows what it's like to have abuse hurled her way because of the way she looks.
Once I was crossing the street and someone just yelled abuse at me only because of my appearance.
She's president of the Muslim Women's Welfare of Australia. And while the incident was a long time ago, it's left its mark.
He doesn't know who I am. He doesn't know the good work that I do for the community. He judged me by my appearance, unfortunately.
Fatin Eldana says for Muslim women in particular, Islamophobia is distressing.
This is not only limiting their freedom of movement and participation in the society, but it's causing feelings of isolation and exclusion.
Today, a report on discrimination faced by Muslims in Australia has been released, and the results are telling. Aftab Malik is Australia's special envoy to combat Islamophobia.
Today marks a critical and long-awaited moment for the Muslim communities of Australia. This is a historic opportunity. It is a moment where we decide who we are as a country and whether we are prepared to take the necessary steps to ensure that every person in Australia, regardless of faith, ethnicity, or background, is safe, valued, and treated with dignity.
Islamophobia is a dislike, fear, or prejudice towards Muslims. And the report, which has been released by the envoy and the government, finds it's rife in Australia. In a survey conducted this year, one in three Australians expressed negative attitudes towards Muslims, a 27% rise on the previous year. And when it comes to reported incidents of everyday Islamophobia, it's women who are attacked the most. Many have had their hijabs pulled and ripped off and verbally abused. And the incidents continue to be recorded.
In the past week alone, we have had a fake bomb left outside a Gold Coast mosque, and 1,700 students from Queensland's largest mosque evacuated due to a bomb threat. Here in Sydney, the Islamophobia Register recorded an alleged incident in which a 55-year-old Arab man was repeatedly punched in the face while he was waiting at a bus stop. This was after the assailant allegedly targeted another Muslim passenger while saying Islamophobic slurs. These are the consequences of leaving Islamophobia unaddressed.
Since the Hamas terrorist attack in Israel on the 7th of October 2023, Islamophobic incidents in Australia have skyrocketed, with a 150% increase in verified in-person Islamophobic incidents in the first year after the attacks. The Islamophobia Register of Australia plays a key role in quantifying them. Sharah Attai is a co-executive director.
A lot needs to be done to mend the fractured relationship between the Muslim community and government.
The special envoy Aftab Malik makes 54 recommendations. They include developing behavioural codes of conduct for all Australian parliamentarians and staff. And when it comes to the police, the report recommends officers receive sensitivity training around Islamophobia.
The evidence aligns with what Muslim communities of Australia have shared with me, and that is Islamophobia is not only interpersonal, it is also institutional and structural. It affects Muslim students and professionals. Opportunities for employment, accessing services, and interactions with law enforcement. It affects every part of their life.
Mr. Malik also suggests the Racial Discrimination Act should be clarified to specifically include Muslims, as it does Jews and Sikhs. He says he hopes the report helps eliminate racial hatred across Australian society.
We welcome it, we support it. We want to sort of see the recommendations and how that can be implemented across all fabric of society. And it's not just about helping address, you know, one particular community, but it's about what can we do as a collective society to ensure that there is no racial bigotry or hatred across any element of our ethnic diversity.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says his government would consider all of Mr. Malik's recommendations, but said he would not progress religious discrimination laws without bipartisan support.
That report from Diana Damjanovic. Tomorrow night, we'll see a historic moment in the Australian Football League. For the first time in its history, two Queensland teams are meeting in a finals game. The reigning premiers, the Brisbane Lions, are taking on the Gold Coast Suns at the Gabba in Brisbane. The Suns' patient fans have waited 15 years to see them play in the finals. Mark Rigby prepared this report.
There were beautiful blue skies on the Gold Coast today, but there were sun worshippers of a different kind painting the town red. Sun supporters turned out in droves to watch the final training session at Carrara Stadium before the big game. The first time the two Queensland teams have met in a final.
So excited. I've been waiting a long time for this weekend. So yeah, it's taken a while to get here. Yeah, been members for, 13 years? So, yes, long time coming.
That loyalty to the club isn't in short supply.
Yes, we've been members since the day it started. So, yeah, very, very excited.
Tomorrow's battle between the Gold Coast Suns and the Brisbane Lions represents a big step forward for the AFL, which is desperate to grow the game in Queensland. Brisbane entered the competition as the Bears in 1986, then merged with the Fitzroy Lions in 1996. After some tough years, they've now won four premierships, including last year's. The Suns have a very different story. They entered the comp in 2011 and have struggled, never making the finals until this year. The young club hasn't won a game at the Gabba since 2018, and that's the venue for tomorrow's clash.
We're driving, then we're staying two nights in there, hopefully celebrating on Sunday.
We're rubbing it into the Brisbane locals.
Yes, no. Bit nervous about playing Brisbane, but just got to have faith in how we beat them last time.
But there's also strong support for the Lions from fans like Jennifer Rathbone.
We always hope.
Yes.
There's always hope, and we did it last year. I don't see why we can't do it again this year.
ABC Sport commentator Quentin Hull covers the AFL.
Certainly, Brisbane has had the upper hand over the Suns, but I think that's probably been a little tempered by just the comprehensive nature about the way that the Suns won that game most recently, where they won by 11 goals. And Brisbane come into this game with a few questions about their form and injuries. And look, they've been inconsistent at the Gabba this year. It's strange to think that a team that's been so successful, you know, the Gabbatoir is no longer really, because they've had a better record on the road.
He says it's the biggest AFL game in Queensland since the 2020 Grand Final.
Of course, that was during the very strange COVID season when Richmond beat Geelong and claimed the Premiership Cup. We've actually said it a couple of times already this season that this is the biggest Q clash ever. We said it before the game in May, which was a long weekend holiday in Brisbane, which the Lions won comfortably at the Gabba. And then as the Suns got closer to their maiden finals appearance, we said it for the game down at Carrara recently, where the Suns won really comfortably. But look, we were probably right by saying it was the biggest Q clash ever for those games, but nothing to this level.
Quentin Hull says the Lions and the Suns have a sibling rivalry, and that makes an all-Queensland clash particularly special.
What this final will do will just take that level of niggling of one-upmanship to the next level. We see it in Adelaide when there's a showdown and Perth for the Derby. And there's a lot of fans in Queensland who have the opposite team as their second team. when you get through an experience like Saturday night, when that second team knocks yours out of the finals race. And that's going to be the reality for the first time.
That's the ABC's Quentin Hull, that report from Mark Rigby. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by David Sargent, Joram Toth and Nick Drakoulis. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was another act of political violence in a nation too accustomed to it. Charlie Kirk, a 31-year-old right-wing political activist, was shot and killed while he addressed a crowd at a US university. Today, Jeff Kabaservis from the centre-right think tank, the Niskanen Centre, on what unfolded. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.